Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
James Baldwin, American writer, civil rights activist, once said, "People are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them." We at Radio Boston are fascinated by history, and we want to spend time diving deeper into it. Sometimes the best way to understand our history is to understand the people who walked through it and left their mark. And today we explore the life and poetry of Phyllis Wheatley. Abducted from her home in the Senegal region of West Africa before the Revolutionary War, brought to Massachusetts and sold into slavery at age 7 or 8. She went on to be the first Black poet to have a book of poetry published in America. This month actually marks 250 years since the first announcement about her work being published in Boston. The Massachusetts Historical Society will offer an exhibit of Wheatley's work starting later this spring. And joining us now, Peter Drummy, chief historian at the Massachusetts Historical Society. Peter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So maybe begin with kind of how cool was she? Where does she fit in the pantheon of Massachusetts poets?
She's an extraordinary figure. It's a life that couldn't be invented. Tragic. Begins with this terrible voyage on a slave ship to America. Her name actually comes from the name of the ship that brought her as a young child here to Boston in the summer of 1761. We don't know her age, probably 7 or 8. Purchased by John Wheatley, a successful Boston tailor who had become a merchant, lived right along King Street, what we call State Street today, by the old State House. So she lived right in the heart of Boston in this household where, in a peculiar way, she may have been, as a young child, a replacement for a daughter the Wheatleys, John and Susanna Wheatley, had lost years earlier, about the same age as that daughter who had died. So she learned English. The Wheatleys provided her with, for the day, a remarkable education for a girl growing up in Boston, and started reciting and then having her poems published when she was still a young teenager in the 1760s. And by 17, oh, go ahead.
Well, no, so finish that by 17, and then I want to pick up there.
1772, she had either written or published enough poems to make a compilation of them in book form, to set out a proposal to publish by subscription, sort of 18th century crowdsourcing of a volume of her poetry.
So let's pick up there. And I want to note the building that you're in is desperate to participate in this call. And I know that you're getting some wonderful background noise from the building there, which is a magnificent building. So we're going to welcome the building to be a part of this conversation as we go.
That's a large chimney near my
office. There you go. It's all part of the history. It's a great building. All right. So I want to pick up there. Lots of people write poems. She managed to break through. I am not making light of the incredible resilience of being enslaved and writing poetry. I want to stick with the poetry for a minute and its breakthrough into American publishing. And I guess I'm assuming it must have been particularly remarkable given the firsts that she achieved.
Yes, in fact, there's two things about it. One is this effort to publish this poetry in Boston was not successful. Massachusetts is still a colony within the British Empire. This is before the American Revolution. And the following year, both her poems, manuscript poems, and Phyllis Wheatley herself travel to England, where they're published in 1773 in London. She has a benefactor there, where there were never enough subscribers here in Boston to publish her poetry. But as a colony, literature and poetry was largely printed in the home country, and then even poetry written here brought back to America.
I'd like to pause you there. I'd love to play just a little bit of a poem. The poem is To the King's Most Excellent Majesty. It was written in 1768, and here it is being read by Ariel Gray, who is the arts engagement producer here at WBUR. Let's listen.
May George, beloved by all the nations round, live with heaven's choicest constant blessings crowned. Great God, direct and guard him from on high, and from his head let every evil fly. And may each clime with equal gladness see, a monarch's smile can set his subjects free.
So it's remarkably topical. I read a selection of her poems to prepare to talk with you today, many of them topical. And here she is actually straddling two worlds, one in which when she's there in England, slavery has already been abolished and she has the status of a free woman, and one back here, and she comes back, where she has the status of being enslaved. And yet she writes this topical material that straddles these worlds.
Yes, this is one of the striking things about this. And in her life, she came back to America with the support for her the people she had met and her benefactors in England, to with the promise of emancipation here in Massachusetts. So she came back from a place that if she hadn't left, she would have been, as you say, she would have been free, to a place where there was an agreement within the Wheatley family to emancipate. But she's living in a world where at a time, the approach of the American Revolution, where there's still this idea that the king might in fact be the friend of the American colonists and its parliament, that they're standing in the way of American a broader latitude as colonists here. So she's writing about it in her proposal of poems here in Boston in 1772. She lists a poem on the Boston Massacre that had taken place in 1770. When her poems are published in England, that's a poem that's not part of the poems on various subjects, religious and moral, as her poetry is titled in book form.
So, you know, we're talking about the way she reflected the reality of the time. And one thing that's interesting to me about speaking about her today is we're claiming her. We're claiming her as a part of Massachusetts. She didn't choose to be part of Massachusetts. She was abducted. I'm thinking of a book we recently talked with author Jabari Asim about, his book Yonder. And in it, those who are enslaved refer to themselves as the stolen and the enslavers as thieves. And that's the context. She was stolen into Massachusetts. How do we grapple with someone we claim as being from here?
And again, this is someone who was a very young child, was in a voyage where almost 25% of the stolen people from Africa died on that voyage to Boston. And then she's a remarkable person in her own right, apart from her origins as an enslaved child. But that's part of her life throughout her very brief
And it was brief, right? She died in her early 30s, and as I understand it, so she came back with the promise of emancipation. As I understand it, Peter, she was eventually, I don't want to use granted her freedom, because it wasn't somebody else's to give her, and yet, at the time, granted her freedom. And yet, much of her later young life, we don't know a lot about.
Yes, we've had a series of remarkable discoveries only in the very recent past. So we know a little bit more. It's still a life that's obscured by her circumstance. But she comes back to Boston. The Wheatleys, there's no pretty way to say this, her owners, but people that she lived with in a family relationship, die, and their children, their older children, die as well. So the family that she's connected with as a slave, but nevertheless connected with, all die in the years of the at the period of the revolution.
So they don't actually free her?
Oh, they do. She's freed essentially, appears to have been freed essentially by agreement for her return to where she would be, still have the status of an enslaved person, which she would not, she could not have been made to leave England without her agreement. That is,
I see.
That slavery was understood not to exist in England, within the colonies of England, certainly, but not in England itself. But so she has this life, and it's this paradox that where she's been enslaved in a colony, and then she's emancipated, a free person, essentially as slavery begins to end in Massachusetts during the American Revolution, but that doesn't aid her in terms of her circumstance as a young writer. She doesn't have the success that she had when her life was circumscribed by slavery, when it was necessary to go to another country to have a book published. Freedom itself is important, but it's nevertheless, her circumstances are not good. She marries.
We're going to have to wrap here, Peter, just so
you
know. So give us just that last kick.
Yeah, she has that brief, extraordinary life that we all should be interested in.
Peter Drummy is chief historian at the Massachusetts Historical Society. It was fascinating. I appreciate you sharing some of her story with us, and I know you'll have the collection of Wheatley's work at Mass Historical Society. We have that at masshist.org. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.